Welcome to the Perceptive Podcast. My name is Josh Beiser, and we got a great Thanksgiving edition of the Perceptive Podcast this week. My guest tonight is owner of Conifer Games and is currently working on At the Gates. Please welcome John Schaefer.
Thanks, Josh. It's good to be back and looking forward to talking some games and some At the Gates. Thanks again.
Not a problem. Hopefully you're recovered from any turkey-related comas from yesterday and you're ready to talk design.
I spent so much time cleaning up afterwards that I think I worked off the entire dinner we hosted here and had a bunch of people over. So as anybody knows that's done that sort of thing before, you spend a lot of time picking things back up. So it's, we transitioned back pretty quickly, I guess. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's still fun. I like taking care of things and having people over.
Yeah, I'm just not really a big turkey man myself, so I don't eat a lot of it. And I've never had enough that would knock me out, but I have family that they eat and then, you know, they're done for the rest of the night.
Yeah, yesterday was a little bit different. This morning we were busy, but yeah, last night pretty much just eating a little bit too much, but that's what it's for. Then you can feel bad about it later.
And as we are recording tonight, is pretty much we're in the middle of Black Friday. So John, were you able to survive with your wallet intact?
I did, yeah. After cleaning, I pretty much just got back to work and did some playtesting and some tweaks on the game. So it's actually, when everything is crazy outside, it's a good opportunity to sit down and get some stuff done on the game. But working from home, it's makes it a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's I try to avoid the crowds. So even if I, you know, it's not really technically a 9-to-5 anymore, so I can kind of come and go as I please and work whatever hours I want. So I tend to avoid rush hour, and when I do end up getting caught in it, I'm just like, wow, forgotten what this was like. So you know, my thoughts are with everyone out there who deals with it every day.
Yeah, I'm lucky that I work from home as well, so I don't really have to travel out, and thanks to, you know, sites like Amazon and Best Buy and all that, I don't need to, you know, rush to stores and wait in lines for stuff. I think the last time I, like, literally wait in a line for a game would probably be when I did a whole Dreamcast, $9.99.
Well, that's, yeah. Yeah. It was a little while ago now.
Yeah, now I get to be even older. That's great.
Hey, we all know the truth.
Yeah. I guess the only big thing that I bought was I ordered the Wii U finally. This was my big, you know, Christmas holiday present for me. So now I'm just sitting here waiting for it to get here. It's somewhere between, I think, Ohio and New Jersey. I have no idea where at the moment, but hopefully it will get here soon.
Yeah, that's the advantage brick and mortar stores will always have over the internet, regardless of pricing. You can't just push a button and have it appear within an hour, at least not yet.
Yeah. If Amazon has their ways with their drones, maybe at some point.
I'm sure they'd love to.
Mm-hmm. So, with that said, let's get to our first topic, and I want to talk with John about the recent release of Sid Meier's Civilization Beyond Earth. Now, this was the quote-unquote, I guess it would be considered like a spin-off of Civilization at this point. It's not really a spiritual successor of Alpha Centauri, which I know a lot of people were really hoping for. It's essentially more of a... It's hard to say if it's of a mod or a reskin of Civ 5, as it features a lot of the basic DNA. You have one unit per hex, you're dealing with, instead of happiness, you have health, and combat still follows that same paradigm of you have the attack stat, and you're trying to pretty much whittle the enemies down and finish them off before they can get a counterattack in. Now, what makes Beyond Earth so different is, of course, the whole sci-fi theme, from how you now choose your sponsor and you can customize your starting conditions more, to, of course, the very, very expansive tech tree, which acts more like in a spiderweb formation as opposed to the linear left to right of previous Civ titles. Now, the problem with Beyond Earth, and what has been cited in a lot of reviews, is that a lot of people felt that the game was very much bare bones compared to previous Civ titles. It didn't have as much of a lasting appeal as Civ 4 and Civ 5 did. Now, John, did you have a chance to sit down and play Beyond Earth yet?
I have. Not extensively. I've been pretty busy with At the Gates. But I probably put in maybe 3 or so hours. A lot of it was just poking around and seeing what was there and getting a feel for the interface and just the game generally. So I don't have I wouldn't say a super in-depth understanding of the mechanics, but I've been following the game and kind of aware of what big features they were aiming for and the response to it. So yeah, I'm definitely familiar with it. I wouldn't call myself an expert though by any means.
Now, the first thing I want to talk about with Beyond Earth is the affinity system. And this is one of like the newer features for the game. And how it worked was, depending on what technologies you research and different choices after building specific structures, would basically tilt your civ or your colony's morality down one of three roads. You have like the cybernetic, you know, keep modifying your body type faction. You have the more like human, we want to say pure. And then you have the, we're going to completely side with aliens and the whole alien biology side. And how they tailored the game was, instead of having a huge unit list, the amount of units of the game were kept very small. And then as you went up the different virtue trees or affinity trees, it would basically transform your units based on those specific types. And it's a very interesting concept, and this is one of the things I did like, because it felt like it was easier to manage as opposed to having all these units. But it also felt somewhat limiting, because once you go down one of those tracks, you pretty much have to stay, you know, to the course in order to get all the benefits out of it. What did you think of the system, John?
Yeah, my thoughts kind of line up with your own. It's a similar model to how social policies were in Civ 5, and you know, there have been certainly other very similar systems in other games and in the expansions as well. But yeah, I think the big drawback that you point out is the fact that it railroads you into a certain path a little bit. And yeah, you can bounce around and go up the different tracks. You're not forced to just pick one, boom, that's it. But it's not sort of a situation where you have several axes along which you can consider decisions. So it's, you know, comparison to At the Gates, let's say, if you have a clan that is in, I don't know, agriculture, let's say, it benefits you to continue going down agriculture, but you can switch that clan to a completely different field if you need to. And at that point, there's really no momentum or cost or baggage. Once you switch them, then you've switched them, and then you get all the rewards, and then, you know, that old life is basically gone. So you can kind of change directions at any point in any way. And sometimes that makes a lot of sense, sometimes not as much, but there's always that flexibility of, oh, I can go in any direction with this. And there's a different feel to that than when you're on a track that's very clearly laid out in front of you.
Yeah. Now, speaking of a track versus having those options available, we definitely need to talk about the Beyond Earth tech tree. This is probably one of the biggest departures from previous Civ-style games. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, in the traditional Civilization model, you're dealing with a linear tech tree from left to right, because you're obviously following the evolution of, you know, real-life civilization. You know, you're going to pick up stuff like riding, horseback riding, blacksmith, you know, just because that's how civilizations evolve. In Beyond Earth, they basically had all that stuff already researched, and you're dealing with future tech. And how that worked was, you start in the middle, and then you have different researchers basically surrounding you. And as you pick a direction, they're usually tailored to culture, economy, technology, military, stuff like that. You can go down the specific paths, and then each research then has essentially more specialized versions that you can research within that one specific tech upgrade. And it's pretty much designed that you literally cannot research everything, just because you'll never have enough time to do it. And again, it goes back to the affinity system and how certain researchers would start giving you more points or push you towards one of those three tracks. Now, since you, John, designed Civ 5 and kept with the traditional tech tree, what did you make of having this, you know, massive options available for the player?
Honestly, I'm kind of split on it, because on one hand, the fact that you can't get everything and you do have all that flexibility is exactly what I was talking about, is a good thing just a few minutes ago. But on the other hand, it's just so complex and so daunting that I feel like a lot of people have had trouble, or would have trouble, just wrapping their head around what what it is that's going on and what direction to go and how to progress through it. It's kind of that catch 22 of you want systems or games generally that are easy to learn but hard to master. And this seems like the kind of system that has the potential to be hard to master, but it also seems, at first glance, hard to learn right off the bat. And that's kind of compounded by the fact that you are dealing with these futuristic technologies and don't have a point of reference to build from. Mm-hmm. If you're playing in Civ, then you understand ironworking and the wheel and then chivalry and gunpowder and rocketry. These are things that mean something to us, and we kind of understand how they're laid out hierarchically and what they might do for us. But when you're dealing with something completely abstract, then you don't have that to work from. So on top of that, which is just inevitable if you're making a futuristic sci-fi game, you have to make some stuff up. Then you add this other layer to it where it's like, okay, well, now you can kind of go in any direction and things kind of connect up in strange ways. And again, that can add a lot of strategy, but there's a downside to it. So, it kind of goes both ways. It's tough because as a designer, you're often faced with those kinds of features or decisions. How much learnability are you willing to sacrifice for depth or vice versa? Mm-hmm. I tend to lean a little bit more to the usability end, and then try to add more systems that can interact together to provide that sort of depth. So if you have several easy to learn, easy to understand systems, they can interact in complex ways and give you that depth instead of having one system that's potentially just really hard to wrap your head around. So yeah, as I've said, it's tough. I can see the pluses and the minuses in it.
Yeah, man, you made a really good point about how with previous civilization models, you have that logical understanding of real-world technologies. You ask someone, what are satellites? They have a good idea, or circuitry, or rocketry. But when you have stuff like xenobiology, health structures, it's like, what the hell does that mean? And as you said, when you start having all these different multi-connected ideas and researches, it becomes harder to try to establish a game plan. Which, as you said, again, it's at catch-22. It's great that you have all these options available, but if the player can't make any sense of what they're looking at, then they're never going to figure that out or take it to an advanced level.
Yeah, one thing I will say, though, is it's definitely not as bad as Al Centauri's hidden research, where you can't actually even see the tech tree, and it's just kind of scrambled up. So it's... again, some people like that, and there's stuff to it that makes it interesting. The fact that you don't know what you're going to run into each game adds certainly a level of replayability and kind of mixes up the strategy, so you don't kind of get stuck in a rut of, well, okay, I researched this, and I researched this, and then that in every game. But, the downside of that is, hey, you might not have any idea what's going on whatsoever. Yep. So there's a cost.
Yep, and when you start throwing in, random researches, it becomes really hard to exactly know what you should be focusing on. Like, if you're trying to build a infrastructure or more focus on economy, but all you're getting are, military or researches that have nothing to do with your strategy, you're kind of SOL for that gameplay. I think one game that I did play that also did the random research route was the original Elemental by Stardock. I'm trying to remember, but I think they also did that you choose either a military research, infrastructure research, economy research, and then it basically just picks or gives you a pool of various research that you can try to pick up once you've, researched enough points into that specific track.
Yeah, technology trees are really, really tough. Just even the simplest, most basic ones, because it's just hard as a designer to figure out what makes these things fun. Obviously, progressing is good, but how do you lay things out? What are the branches? Are the branches related to specific disciplines? Is this the agriculture branch? Is this the construction branch? Or do you kind of mix things up and say, well, we want to have different ways of getting everything in each branch. So how do you mix that up? And how do things connect together? And is it intuitive what leads to what? And is there enough choice? Is there too much choice? It's crazy. One tech model that I actually really like and have kind of been tempted to integrate into some of my games is from Master Orion, where you have tech tiers And instead of a tree specifically, it's like, okay, you have level one in blah, 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 whatever, you know, let's say weapons. And you can pick one of three technologies to research. And once you've researched that, you can then progress up to the next tier. And that means you can skip things and you have decisions to make there. Okay, which of these do I really want to kind of get to the next level? And you have, I believe it's been a while since I played, but you have the option to kind of go back and backtrack and fill out some of those other ones with most of the factions. Some of them you actually don't have that option. It's kind of one of the ways they make them unique, but you kind of have the depth or breadth approach. And that's actually something I've integrated in some sense into At the Gates, where instead of technologies linking up, you know, this connects to that, this connects to that, this connects to that, there is kind of more of that tiered model where there are columns. And then if you research something in a column, then you can progress to the next column, you know, except for a few exceptions. Like, you know, if you get a, let's say a carpenter, and then, you know, you need a carpenter to get to the shipbuilder. You can't get to the shipbuilder from, like, I don't know, like a stonemason. Wouldn't make sense to be like, okay, well, now we know how to, you know, carve stuff out of stone. Let's build a boat. So some of the things, you know, I kind of had to break away from that model a little bit, but for the most part, it does have that added flexibility. So I think there are indeed models where you can kind of split the difference there a bit and provide some flexibility, allow players to skip past things, but not present them with something just so incredibly complex that a lot of people are going to have a lot of trouble with it.
Now, with At the Gates tech tree, you mentioned that it's basically split into these different columns and you're going up the higher tiers. I don't remember the exact, like, names of your categories. I know you have, like, a military. I remember watching your Let's Play, and you had stuff, you had, like, one track dedicated to, like, literary research, one track for military and stuff like that. In keeping with this idea of the columns, does that mean, like, let's say I go to the third column of military. Does that mean that if I want to research, let's say, agriculture, that I can start at the third column of agricultural, or do I have to go back to the first track for it?
You have to go back to the first track. So, yeah, the different fields are basically independent tech trees, and sometimes they connect up a little bit, but for the most part, yeah, they're separated that way. And then everything that's contained within each field is something that would be appropriate with that field. Okay. So, for example, the authority field has most of the military stuff. You can unlock new military units, make them stronger, that sort of thing. But it also has a profession called the Tariff Collector, which increases the amount of wealth produced by trading posts. And, you know, the idea that Tariff Collector is in authority, you know, that makes sense. That's kind of how things line up. So that's kind of the guiding principle I've used with tech tree design specifically, where I kind of try to pick a specific theme for different branches or different sections and then stick to that as much as possible, because it allows you to do some interesting gameplay things, and it also allows you to work off of the theme in a way that matches with people's expectations. But you do have to be careful what you make those themes for these different branches. So authority is fairly broad, but if I did call it the military tree, then something like the Tariff Collector wouldn't make sense in there. So You do have to put some thought into how you group things, but if you take the approach like I've taken in At the Gates, I think it works pretty well. We're still doing a lot of work on the tech tree, so yeah, we put up the video. I wouldn't be surprised if the tree looks completely different by the end of the project, but that's just kind of how game development goes, so I don't think too many people should be surprised by that. That's why we're still in alpha.
So keeping with the example with the authority tree, so does that mean if, let's say I go way down to military or into unlocking military units, and then I want to say, hey, I want to now get the Tariff Collector. If he was like three columns in, I'm at like five columns in terms of military, will I be able to quickly unlock him? Or how is that sort of how you're going with the whole column system?
Yep, that's pretty much how it works. So as long as it's in the same field, then yeah, if you're beyond it, you can go back and research it right away.
Okay, cool. Now, keeping with talking about turn-based strategy games, what are your thoughts on the games that tend to have like wildly different tech trees per each faction? There are a lot of 4X style games that go that route, that maybe one civ has more military researches, or maybe one civ has like no culture, stuff like that. I'm thinking that will tend to get things like really muddy if you start trying to break everyone down and trying to say, okay, this guy has no science whatsoever, so what are we going to give him instead?
Yeah, that's a really, really tough question when it comes to game design. Mm-hmm. And this is actually something I've spoken with on the old podcast I used to co-host called the Game Design Roundtable. We had another game designer named David Serlin, and he's worked in the tabletop space a lot. He's also helped design some fighting games, and he's really, really big into balance and asymmetry. So he is all about making the factions asymmetrical in every way possible. Mm-hmm. So he's really, really big into that, and I can see where it's coming from. You can, if you have 10 factions that all play completely differently, then you know, odds are pretty good that players are going to get more replayability out of that than a game where there are 10 factions and they're all identical, or mm-hmm. you know, essentially you have one faction alone, regardless of what else you've done with the game. So if you can balance all those unique factions, then all the better. If you've balanced your one faction, then it's still probably not going to appeal to people, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of people, not everyone, but quite as much as if you did have those 10 really unique ones. So I tend to lean more in the direction of having a core game that really offers a lot of options and not pushing players too far with the factions themselves. Mm-hmm. But that said, you know, some people are really looking for that. That's what they want. And, you know, I'm going to be including a certain number of factions in At the Gates that are pretty unique in that way. And the way I kind of reconcile that is by having certain factions that are kind of more vanilla. These are the, you know, this is kind of, you play the game as the game. Mm-hmm. And then there's, you know, the other half, which are kind of crazy and, you know, exclude certain systems and take other ones to 11 and very, very extreme things. Mm-hmm. If I were making a game just for me, you know, just to play, I would probably kind of make things aim a little bit more towards the center and then try to push players in ways that affect them during the game. So in mm-hmm. terms of what resources are available, their geography, you know, even things like events where the player can choose how to respond, and it's more involved than just, you know, click a button and get a bonus, or click a button and, you know, now you're evil, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You want more attachments, more features, more knobs than that. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where I fall on faction design, and unique tech trees kind of fit very much into that. So mm-hmm. you can make completely unique tech trees for all your factions, but that's a lot of work. And, you know, some people are going to really appreciate that. Other people, not as much. And you're probably spending a lot of time on it. So for me personally, it's not a direction that I would probably go with any of my games. I would probably focus a little bit more on the mechanical side in terms of differentiation. But mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really one of those gray areas where it's tough to say one way or the other. That this is good or bad, because a lot of people like it both ways. Mm-hmm.
So what you're essentially saying then is that you prefer that the core experience or the foundation is the same for every player, but then using mechanics, you can then sort of branch out into wildly different paths and strategies from that same beginning.
Exactly, because that allows, that puts the player in the driver's seat. You can mm-hmm. say, all right, well, there are these resources available. Which one do I want to grab and mm-hmm. kind of build my strategy around? And you don't want to make it so deterministic that it's basically the same as picking which faction and then playing that very specific way. Mm-hmm. If you have, all right, well, there's this one resource near me, I guess this is how this game's going to play, you know, mm-hmm. that's really no better. But if you kind of layer things over one another, okay, there's these four resources and I can simultaneously, you know, build a strategy around two of them, but I can't do all four. I just don't have the resources, mm-hmm. you know, so to speak, to kind of invest enough to make that worth my while. So I have to decide how these things fit together. And, you know, ideally, as a designer, you can make it so that they're in different situations and different player styles, that you can kind of switch it up between games, that it's not obvious which two of the four make sense. So that's my preference, at least. I think it ultimately can lead to more replayability value. If you can pull it off, you can come up with a game that people will play for 5 or 10 years instead of, you know, if you have really unique stuff that's yeah. kind of set in motion right from the beginning, then, okay, somebody might play 3 times instead of once, but, you know, that's not 10 years.
Yeah, it's just basically, it's as broad as it is long. You give them, like, a wildly different beginning, but the middle and the end are the same, they're still going to run out of viable strategies very quickly. as you said, there's a difference between a game that can last 5 to 10 years and one that you've basically seen everything in after, let's say, 3-4 playthroughs.
Right, and making a game that people will be playing, you know, religiously 10 years from now is no small task, mm-hmm. and not something that you can just be like, all right, we're this is what we're gonna make.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's kind of the thing that I'm aiming for with At the Gates, and we're taking our time to try and get to that point.
Mm-hmm.
You can at least try, I guess.
Yeah.
you can aim in that direction and see how close you get, but yeah, you have to at least try.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you're definitely not going to get there.
Now, speaking about having like a personalized or a more customizable beginning, what are your thoughts on Beyond Earth's essentially, you sort of quote-unquote build your own colony from the start? You choose a sponsor, you choose different types of spaceships, and then you choose like your general, like what you're bringing on the spaceship. And those different aspects will influence your starting resources, what you can do from the beginning, and stuff like that.
It seems like a system that really is aimed at people that like the character customization side of, mm-hmm. of a lot of games, like MMOs or RPGs generally. And, you know, I can see the appeal to that. But as a kind of a mechanical, you know, crunchy gameplay guy, mm-hmm. doesn't really work for me because, you know, when strategy really works, when a strategy game works, or when a strategic system works, it's mm-hmm. when players have just enough information to make an informed decision that they're confident about, but not so much that they know exactly how it's going to work out and that it was the obvious choice from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're building a faction or a character or something before you actually start the game and see what the environment's going to be and what's going to happen,
mm-hmm.
then you're kind of going in blind. You're not making strategic decisions, you're making aesthetic decisions, or you're making decisions about, you know, it's kind of like a map setup.
Mm-hmm.
I want to play, you know, an islands map with you know, a lot of food on it. And again, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but
mm-hmm.
as a pure strategy, you know, when I'm thinking about pretty much every mechanic I ever add, I'm thinking about, okay, well, how is this going to pose a difficult decision that
mm-hmm.
Players have a hard time deciding because they're weighing different options? And, you know, is this something that's going to be interesting 10 years from now? You know, kind of tying into the thing that we were just talking about. And when you have character creation, again, some people just love it, and that's great, but it's not as much something that is in my wheelhouse.
Okay. Now, going back to Beyond Earth, one thing that I definitely want to bring up is the subject of the combat system. And combat in a turn-based strategy game is one of those very debated topics, because there's just a huge swing between different systems. We have games like Total War, Age of Wonders, that basically gives you a completely different tactical system when you go into battle. And then we have on the other end of the spectrum games like Civilization, or a lot of other strategy games where you just watch your two units interact for a second and then you get the readout. Now, with Beyond Earth, it definitely falls more in line with previous Civilization styles, where it's all heavily abstracted. You have like a very basic idea that says, you know, clean victory, decisive victory, or, you know, absolute failure. Now, for combat in turn-based strategy games, John, what are your thoughts on like a good system, or where you like the degree of tactical gameplay to be when you're playing a strategy game?
that's a big question.
I know.
Ultimately, I think it comes down to what kind of game you're aiming to make. And if it's combat focused, if it's economics focused, if you're trying to blend the two, you know, kind of where your center of gravity is.
Mm-hmm.
I think the direction that I've kind of been moving in is to make it a little bit more strategic and a little bit more abstract, so that the actual combat itself and the actual units themselves are fairly simple. And then the idea is to get to the battle with the right combination of things and to fight in the right place,
mm-hmm.
You know, in a way that is advantageous to you. So if you're already outnumbered and out-technologied, they're more advanced than you, and you're fighting a place where you have no supply, then you basically already lost.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the direction I've taken At the Gates in, where you have just a stack of units, but your goal as the attacker is to kind of wear down the enemy, or not even actually not wear them down, but the exact opposite. You want to punch through and take out their morale and force them to retreat because that causes them to take a lot of damage. Mm-hmm. The defenders want to hold on and wear down the attackers because the attacking force takes more damage, the defending force loses more morale.
Okay.
So the attackers, you know, in an even fight, if you just have one, you know, spearman against one spearman and they keep fighting each other, eventually the defender will win because the attacker will take too much health damage that can only be healed back at home.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to think about it strategically in terms of, all right, well, I have this army. What can I do with it? What am I facing here? Okay, I have a 2-to-1 advantage. I can just punch through and knock this army out and go through. If it's 1-to-1, then you might think, ooh, well, let me see if I can kind of maneuver around and maybe try to pillage some of his structures in order to force him to kind of give me some concessions in peace. Maybe I can lay siege to some places. Maybe there's good defensible terrain where I can advance and he can't just kind of hit me. And, you know, I have good supply. I have a supply line. I can kind of manage that. Or there could be other situations where you're just completely in a bad position where you don't have supply and you can't hang around and you kind of need to hurry. And those are the situations when you may just want to go home.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of tactics versus strategy, I'm leaning more in terms of the strategic direction for a 4X Empire Builder style strategy game because it can connect up to the rest of the game in so many other ways.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of specifically what unit goes where, you know, it's a little bit tougher to make that work. Obviously, we did that in Civ 5, and there are a lot of good things about it, a lot of challenges with it as mm-hmm. well. But the direction I've kind of been going is more strategic now.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of health versus morale, does morale recover generally quickly, or does it take like several turns for you to start to see morale raise up?
For the most part, it recovers relatively quickly. So if let's, you know, you have 100 points of health and 100 points of morale, you'll recover 20 points of morale per turn, and a battle you might lose 30 or so as the defender if it's a 1-to-1 fight, or maybe 40, something like that. So the attacker, really, just if it's 1-on-1, they're gonna have a tough time taking you out unless, you know, you're stuck on crossing a river or something like that,
mm-hmm.
Or you're encamped, that sort of thing. If you can get snuck up on, then it can be trouble if you're defending. But otherwise, especially if you're in a fortified position, if you spent some time just hunkered down, then it's going to be pretty much impossible to uproot you through normal means.
Mm-hmm.
And in a normal battle, you might see, let's say, the defender loses 10% health and 40% morale, whereas the attacker is kind of the other way around, 40% health and 10% morale. So the two are added together to get your overall combat strength. So immediately after the battle, both sides will be, you know, roughly equal in strength because they'll both have lost the same total amount. But then after the turn ends, the defender will recover 20% of that morale and then have a chance to counterattack against what used to be the attacker, who's now 40% health down and has a good chance of knocking him back to retreat them because their strength is now lower.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, to make a long story short, it's kind of a push your luck system where you have to decide, all right, well, am I going all in or am I not? There's very few, okay, you know, minor skirmishes, minor battles. Let's kind of grind each other down. It's pretty much, all right, well, is there going to be a battle? All right, let's fight, see what happens. And then within a turn or two, you pretty much know how it's going to end up.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you just said regarding attack strength, do the units lose like how much damage they do if they have less health or less morale or a combination of the two?
It's so if you lose, so as I was saying, you have 100 points of health, 100 points of morale, let's say, mm-hmm. and let's say the strength of your unit is 5.
Mm-hmm.
If you lose half your health, then you know, the way the system works is kind of like whatever your lowest one is, that's kind of, you know, they're added together and then modified. So if you're 40% health, then your strength can be no higher than 40% of your original strength. The same thing for morale. So you kind of want to make sure that both are in pretty good shape.
Mm-hmm.
If you lose all your morale, then you're basically useless regardless of how much strength you have. So that's something else that we can tie into strategically if you run out of supply or
mm-hmm.
You run out of food at home and nobody's getting fed and your morale drops, then just because you have a really powerful advanced army, that doesn't mean you're going to be able to maintain an effective fighting force. Same thing with supply. If you cut off somebody's supply, you run out of supply, then suddenly their strength just kind of withers away. And that's something that was inspired in large part by the game Unity of Command, where supply was everything. You kind of want to encircle and defeat your enemies. And if you were able to do that, you would win pretty quickly, regardless of who you're up against. So again, that's kind of more the strategic focus of I'm worrying about cutting off the supply. And there's certainly a tactical element to that as well. But it's not, you know, it's more about did I properly prepare my supply line or not? Did I build supply depots along the way? If I didn't, then once winter comes around, I'm in a, you know, a really tough spot, and I'm probably not going to be able to successfully complete my invasion. If I did, then there's a good chance I will. But of course, doing so is very expensive. So it all ties back into the economics and the higher level big decision of, okay, do I build a supply line or not? If I do, then okay, that means this. If I don't, it means that.
Okay. Now, going back to the whole question of tactical versus strategic play, for me, I find I tend to prefer more of the strategic side. I don't like to play a strategy game where I'm basically breaking up my time between managing the empire and I spend, you know, 15, 20 minutes doing a tactical battle, then I go back. It just seems to break up the flow for me. But with that said, I do like games that give me the strategic options, but then allow me to sort of have some control or some semblance of being able to affect combat rather than just throwing two units at each other. It's one of the things that we saw with like Civilization, where, as you said, if you can catch them on like crossing a river, or if you're holding a hill and fortify, that makes you a lot stronger than if both of you were fighting just on planes. In terms of at the gates, are there any like strategic sides of or strategic options of trying to catch someone in a poor position? Like, is there a way to attack someone from behind, or is it generally based on where your units are in terms of the environment type?
It's there is some level of tactics to it. So there's the supply element where if you can cut off their supply if they're far from home, if they're inside their own borders, then you're not going to really be able to do that. So there's kind of an inherent advantage to the defenders. There's also a very, very strong form of zone of control. So if you, the way it works right now is if you have an army next to an enemy army, then neither of your armies can move around the other one. Mm-hmm. And if they have two choices at that point, they can either attack or, well, I guess three, they can stay put, or they can attack, or they can move one tile kind of in a backwards direction, just one tile. So it's not easy to disengage from an enemy army. You either need to fight it out, or you can kind of creep away a little bit. And this can really hurt sometimes, especially if you have a weak unit like a scout and it gets caught next to a bandit camp or something because you weren't paying much attention, or you were being a little reckless. And suddenly, you know, your scout can't just bolt away because it's engaged with the enemy. And a lot of times if the bandits are, you know, an enemy that you're at war with wants to bear down on you, then that's pretty much it, because you can't escape. So that's probably the most tactical element to the system. But, you know, to be fair, it is kind of up there. It's a pretty strong effect, and it's kind of more extreme than anything I've seen in any other 4X game, at least. But yeah, the combat is generally focused on stacks, and then kind of what you do with the stack. If you want to advance, if you're going in with supply, if you're going to go from this direction, if your goal is to lay siege to the enemy, if you're trying to find the army and just smash it because you have a big advantage, you know, again, a lot of these high level decisions. Yeah, it's something that is still being refined and worked on, but I'm pretty happy with the direction we've gone, with the kind of the balance with morale and health, kind of putting the onus on the attacker to kind of find a decisive engagement that benefits him. Mm-hmm. There's also the option to lay siege to an enemy as well. So if you do kind of have a numbers advantage, you can lay siege to an enemy that's hunkered down and fortified, where normally if you attacked, you would be in big trouble. But if you lay siege, then over time you can wear down their supply and kind of starve them out that way. But if you yourself run out of supply because it's winter and you're in the middle of their territory, then you know, that might not work well for you either. So mm-hmm. if you're prepared and you have the bigger army, then generally you're pretty much guaranteed to win unless your opponent makes a really bad decision.
Now, when you have two units like close to each other, do they sort of support each other in combat, like get attack or defense bonuses, or is that not factored into the combat system?
Well, if two units are stacked together, they're much more effective than one unit by itself or two units separated. But that's pretty much the extent of it. There's no like supporting, okay, this unit's next to this unit, therefore it's stronger. Although, you know, again, there is the zone of control, so it makes the even harder to get around the enemy. So it depends on what your goals are in terms of combat or the military situation. If you want to just slow down the enemy, if you want to actually force him to attack you, or if you're looking for a fight, or if you're really, really not looking for a fight, it really depends.
All right. So I have one more question then, I guess, relating to Beyond Earth itself, and that has to do with their change to the, I guess, what they're called creeps or neutral units, which in Beyond Earth is the alien faction. Now, this is another big departure from previous Civ games, where the only neutral enemies you had to worry about were the barbarians, and they were pretty much only an early game threat. With the aliens, they pretty much stay for the majority of the game, and depending on how you deal with them will affect your overall strategy. You can leave them alone and try to reason with them or become more passive, or you can try to attack them, which in turn will make them more aggressive towards everyone else. And it's a great idea, I think, in terms of making the early game a lot more varied, but it's hard to tell just how much it will affect more aggressive players who are already going to wipe out the neutral enemies to begin with. For you, John, what do you think of the change to the neutral units?
I really like the approach. I think, there's been a number of other strategy games in recent years that have taken a more asymmetrical approach to the world and the factions. Games like AI War, where you are up against the space empire that has far more resources than you, and that's just kind of, you know, the backdrop of the game. It's not four or eight factions that are, you know, thought to be exactly identical in perfect starting symmetry, but it really helps add some spice to the game. And, it's kind of a little bit of something we're integrating in At the Gates as well. With the bandits are a little bit more sophisticated than barbarians from Civ. And then there's also the Romans, who are kind of akin to the aliens in this game, or the Empire in AI War, something like that. So the one thing that you have to be careful about, though, and I think Beyond Earth could do a little bit better job with, is making it clear what the role is of that faction and how they fit in. So if you have these gigantic, ridiculously powerful, potentially hostile units roaming around the map, or even just sitting in one spot, and if you get close to them, they can bite off your head. You have to make sure as a designer that it's very clear to the player what is going to happen. So are they going to bite my head off? Yes or no? And in Beyond Earth, it's a little unclear at times when that's going to be the case and when it's not. And certainly there's things that you can do to make the alien life more upset. But there's also factors like if other factions are causing damage to the planet and making them upset, then you, who have been nice and peaceful with them the whole time, will suddenly be attacked. And you'll say, well, why did this happen? And it won't be clear unless you kind of understand how the system works already. And that's, I think, kind of a strike against it in a way. It's very similar to diplomacy generally, where players need to understand what's going on for the decisions and the gameplay to be meaningful in the first place. If you don't know what's going on, you know, talked about this a little bit already, then you can't really make a decision. If you have no information to work from, then you're just either guessing or you know, spinning a top or rolling a die. There's not much strategy to it.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I agree with you about the aliens in Beyond Earth, was that a lot of the times just how they were just wandering around being passive blocks, but then there's that rule that if you get within two hexes of any of the hives, they basically will immediately turn and attack your units. But it's hard to really communicate that to the player, especially given how the UI is a lot I guess it's more muddled compared to previous Civ titles because of all the alien environment. It was very hard to actually look at Miasma in the game. I just kept walking into it without knowing it. And as you said, without having that greater knowledge of what's going on, it becomes hard to make far-reaching choices or adapting to what's happening in the game.
Yeah, and that's the sort of stuff that can often come out in playtesting or extended development. And with At the Gates, it's going to end up being, gosh, I don't know, about 4 years in total, from start to finish. And that's a long time. That's, you know, actually a fair bit longer than we had on Civ 5 even. And with Beyond Earth, my understanding is that the team only had a year and a half, you know, really full-time development to make the game. And it's a big game. There's a lot of changes. There's a lot of stuff. And it's just hard to balance and polish and get everything in order in such a short period of time. You can make something look really good and look polished in a year, but that doesn't mean it's actually going to hold up under scrutiny and be something you can really understand. And, you know, all the interface things are in the right place and all the colors are just right. And just all the things that you only really get to once you get all the stuff in, and then you say, all right, well, now let's spend the next year actually figuring out how all this is going to work now that we have the pieces in place. It's something that's tough. If you don't have that time, there's really no substitute for it. You can't just throw more people at it. You gotta play test and iterate, and there's no substitute.
Yep. And as you said, with the amount of time they had to work on Beyond Earth, I think that's also left a lot of people feeling that the game does feel a little half-baked. As we talked about, some of the mid-to-end game decisions don't feel as complicated or as interesting as the early game stuff. Now, with Civ 5, of course, Firaxis continued to update. They released, I think, two different expansions for it. So Civ 5 today is a much different game than Civ 5 at retail. And I think a lot of people are sort of buying their time and hoping that the same case will be with Beyond Earth in like a year or a year and a half from now.
Yeah, that's one of the advantages of being a bigger company is that you can't afford to invest that time and you know, do things a little bit further than a smaller company kind of living on the edge is able to justify. You know, if you're a big company, then, you know, it kind of works both ways. It's there are good things, there are bad things, but that's certainly one of the good elements that you have the money to do it right and the incentive because you want people to keep coming back. So yeah, hopefully sounds like they're working hard on it, and hopefully it'll be in really great shape here soon.
Awesome. All right. So with that said, I want to move on and talk a little bit more about At the Gates specifically, because I know that we could pretty much sit here and spend the next 2 hours talking more about Beyond Earth's design and just general strategy gameplay. So with At the Gates, as we talked about earlier, you of course did your hour-long Let's Play video a few months ago, and that was sort of a major update to the game that we've been seeing. So my first question for you, John, is since that video and now that we are going into December, how has progress been on At the Gates?
Well, things are really coming along, and we still have a ways to go. And, you know, I probably say that every time I come on here, but as I was saying, that there's no substitute for time. We're just trying to make sure everything is polished in the right place. So I think I was on the podcast last maybe a year ago or so. I'm trying to remember.
I think it's been like at least 6-7 months at least.
Yeah, so some big things have happened since then, one of which is the clan system, which is kind of a replacement for generic units instead of just population points appearing and then you being able to train it or, you know, generating wealth in your city. Now they're individually named people with traits and, you know, preferences, and you can retrain them in clans, and there are storylines, they can have desires, they can feud with each other. Lots of different stuff that is pretty interesting. And it really adds a lot of character to the game and has been an important addition because of kind of the narrower focus in terms of just scope. So you in At the Gates, you have a single settlement ever, and that's it. So having the clans is almost like each clan is its own city in a way, or, you know, maybe not that complex, but kind of filling that niche, if you will. they're a lot more complex than generic population points or generic units. And that really gives you a lot to do when you're not just continually expanding across the entire map. So that's probably the big one, and everything kind of stems off of that. So in just the past month or so, I've added a couple new features that tie into that to give you more things that you can do with the clans, one of which is apprentices, where you can add a second clan to a structure. If you train a clan to be a farmer, then the farmer can go off and build a farm on some wheat, and that will produce food for you. You can then train another farmer and send it there, and then add it as an apprentice, and that will extend how long the farm will kind of remain active for, because everything degrades in this game, and then once it degrades to a certain point, you have to pack up and move on and go somewhere else on the map. So it really extends the expansion phase of the 4X throughout the entire game. And that's kind of the big focus for the game, is migration and the clans, and then how it fits in with the resources, the depletion, forcing you to move on, that sort of thing. So those are kind of the big things. There's certainly a lot of other details we can get into, but yeah, it's we're finally getting to shaping up those that corner of the game, squaring it away, and then from here on out, our focus is going to be getting the diplomacy system in really good working order, and then AI and polish and balance, and that's and we'll be good to go. Sounds so easy, but still going to take some time.
Yep. Now, the clan system, that's one that myself, I know a lot of people who saw the video were really excited about, because it does add that level of personalization to it that you wouldn't get in a traditional 4X or turn-based strategy game where, you know, you're pumping out 47 soldiers, you know, there's no personality to them, there's no greater detail. Now, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, John, was sort of the formation of the clan system. When I was looking at the video, it sort of reminded me of the game King of Dragon Pass from way back in the day. So how did this whole clan system come about with At the Gates?
Well, it's definitely inspired in part by King of Dragon Pass, and also other games like Crusader Kings, where you have individual characters and they all have personalities and names, and they fit into the game in a way that's more than just mechanics. And that's really came out of sitting down, you know, I guess not quite a year ago, and saying, you know, the game is still missing something. Like, we have the migration, we have the seasonal change, we have the resource depletion. We have these things that are really good hook, but when you play, it just feels like there's something missing. And I didn't want to turn into the kind of game where you have 50 cities or settlements or whatever, in part for thematic reasons, because it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense, but also for gameplay reasons. I think that that's kind of been done, and I want to explore a new territory there. And in enhancing who you're ruling seemed like the obvious step. And kind of adding more a character element to the game and more of a story element, because one of the problems that the game had was that it was just really bland. There was, you know, it was very, very mechanical, which is something, you know, I tend to be more of a mechanical designer than a thematic one, especially when it comes to the nuts and bolts of how does this work. You know, I try to pick up inspiration from different places in terms of what kind of game I'm making and different features. But when it comes down to the actual implementation, a lot of times it's like, all right, well, here are the numbers, here are the things, here are the knobs, this is how these things interact. And I knew I kind of needed to make a change to get away from that a little bit and expand it a little bit more. So that was a big change. Took quite a while to get in. We've gone through several iterations of that system and how it fits in with the professions and you know, the technology like system where you can study and unlock new professions for your clans, that sort of thing. It's taken us a while to get here, but I'm really happy with where we're at now. And now that we have the introduction of the apprentice system, and then the council, which is kind of something else you can do with clans. You have a couple slots that you can put them on the council, and have different effects depending on what traits they have. So there's a lot of things pulling you in different directions. You always have several ways of using your clans and several things you want to do, but never enough clans or never enough time to actually accomplish everything. So you really have to think hard about how it all is going to fit together for you to make it work with your strategy. And yeah, it's a lot of fun already. A lot of people have said, you know, I can't believe this game is still so far out, and you know, looks can be deceiving, especially with strategy games. It's kind of what I've been saying. So it's you know, the video gave us a good opportunity to show off how things are coming together, and the response to it's been really great. You know, better than we were expecting, to be honest. Yeah, the art style is really, really unique and really beautiful. I'm really happy with the team's work on that. And yeah, it's coming together. We just got to take the time to do it right and finish it up now.
And I know, as you were saying a few minutes ago, that you're really aiming at the gates to be something completely different from the other 4X or turn-based strategy games out there. And the clan system really takes it into full effect. It does make things look a lot more personable compared to, you know, the massive empire games where you're having, you know, 47 cities, you're managing, you know, 50-100 troops, you're trying to fight three fronts. And as you said, you're aiming for a very tighter scope. You're not dealing with all over the world, all over human history. You're dealing with a very specific time, a very specific circumstance.
There's really a lot of room and potential in the 4X genre that just isn't really being tapped into, in part because these games are incredibly hard to make. But, you know, I feel like that we pretty much, we have Civ, we have Space 4X, and we have Fantasy 4X, and that's pretty much it. And there's a lot more room to play around and explore. And even the other 4X games in the fantasy and space genre, subgenres, tend to be fairly Civ-like. I think we're starting to see that change a little bit, but we still have some ways to go. And yeah, with At the Gates, I basically said, all right, let's make something completely different here. And because we don't have a huge team and we're not spending millions of dollars and there's not a lot of expectations and it's not a big franchise, and you know, we didn't take out a bunch of loans to you know, buy office space and do all these things, we can basically say, yeah, well, you know, in large part, this is kind of an art project, if you will, and we're going to try some things out and see how it goes and make something crazy and new and unique that hasn't been seen or played before, at least in this particular combination of features and elements. And we're going to see how it does. And, you know, it's really shaped up. It's been a difficult process to get here, but, yeah, I think there's a lot of room, and most of the time people are playing it safe either because, you know, they're trying to make sure they can pull off something, or just because people aren't being imaginative enough. But hopefully, At the Gates is just one of many examples of kind of pushing the genre in new directions.
I know there's some other 4X games that came out this year. I know there's Age of Wonders 3, there's Endless Legend, there's probably a few others that are also trying to basically carve out their own path in the 4X genre. And I think that's definitely great, especially with At the Gates. So we're starting to see developers take these chances compared to a lot more the risk-averse of the AAA market, which has really toned down on the strategy genre. Because as you said, in terms of like the big-name AAAs, the only ones I can really think of are like Civilization and StarCraft, and that's even a turn-based strategy game. And then the rest come from the indie or AA market.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, I guess, but in large part, I do honestly think that's because these games are so hard to make. But they are a really good place to be if you're a developer because, yeah, there's not a lot of competition. And, you know, 99% of the time, if you put out a good strategy game on PC, it's going to do well and people are going to love playing it and you're going to make money and you can keep doing it. So, you know, the odds of us not making back the money that we spent making At the Gates is basically zero. And that's a really good place to be. It's hard to do. Not everybody has, you know, not everybody's been a lead designer on the Civilization franchise, I guess, and kind of picked up the experience in terms of both design and how to architect these kinds of games. But it does seem like kind of a missed opportunity because Again, there's a really good audience. There's a loyal group of people that want to play these games and are buying them and enjoying them and coming back for more. So probably the last place I'd want to be is the mobile market. But even some of these other ones like first person shooters or RPGs or whatever, you're kind of, unless you're working in an established franchise, you're kind of entering unknown territory and things might not work out for you. And even if you're a little indie, you might make a great game that nobody notices because the market's so saturated. But people will be paying attention to At the Gates just because, there's not too many games like it. And that's certainly worth something.
Definitely. Now, one other question regarding the clan system that I want to ask you before I forget is during the video, I saw how every time you have a new clan member unlocked, it takes longer to unlock the next one. I think there was a research or a job that would increase the rate. Now, if you start losing clan members, will the rate that you get a new one sort of speed up at that point?
At the moment, it is not. It's kind of a fixed ramp-up rate, in part because I didn't really want to encourage people to kind of lose everybody they had. But for the most part, it's things can tend to be a little bit brutal. So if you're in a situation where, again, if you're fighting a war and you have an army of five clans and they have an army of nine clans, you might just want to go home and not fight because it's not like a stack of tanks in Civ where it's like, all right, well, let me throw them in there. They're already on their way. It's like, no, these are five well-trained clans that you've spent weapons on and trained and, this is a serious investment. This isn't something you're just going to throw away. Sometimes you just want to head home with your tail between your legs, and that's how it should be. So it's the kind of game where you really have to think hard about every decision that you make. So there's fewer decisions than something like Civ, but each one is much harder. So if you do lose that five clan army, then you're in really big trouble, and you really don't want to end up in that situation to begin with.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I think I really do like about what I saw with At the Gates is that you really do need to watch and care for your units. As you said, these are not non-script tank number 75. These are characters with actual stats. They have actual wants or they have actual personality traits that affect them. And if you have someone who's been around since the beginning, it's gotten really high up there, you want to protect that person as much as you can, because if you lose them, it's not like you can just pump out another high-level unit. You really have to cultivate these people over the course of your game.
Yep, exactly. And, of course, to be fair, because they are individual characters, some of them can annoy you some at points in time, and you might want to send them off to fight in a difficult battle, if you will. Some of the clans can be annoying. Some of I had one once that had a gluttonous trait, which meant it ate more food than normal, and they were also like fickle, or I forget exactly what the other one was. So they're always causing trouble and getting into arguments with other clans. I'm like, dude, all right, I should just set you off to go fight the Romans.
Just go somewhere,
And good luck. Here's one weapon.
Enjoy. You can take them all on yourself. You can do it.
So yeah, there's certainly moments like that where it can bring out a lot of character and in what's going on and connect you with these little pictures and ones and zeros in a way that you really don't in a lot of other strategy games.
Now, you talked about over the cast with the clan system how some clans, they may get into disagreements or they may argue with each other. How does that translate into actual game mechanics? Like, do like your units will actually interact with each other? Will it be like a stat penalty or something else?
Yeah, so the clans, each clan has a happiness level. And by default, they're content. And that can go up or down depending on what goes on. If a clan, clans can have desires. A clan that is really interested in, for example, agriculture might really want to work in agriculture and be a farmer or a tiller or something like that. And if you don't do it, they can get upset. So there's a chance where a storyline can be triggered and they come up and they say, hey, this is the thing I want. And then they don't get upset immediately because you kind of have a little bit of a grace period to deal with it. And then Sometimes they'll get upset and that will reduce their happiness, and sometimes they'll get really angry and that'll really cause a problem. Okay. And if they're upset, it kind of, you know, it's like a slap on the wrist a little bit. They're a little bit less productive. Their morale drops a little bit if they're a warrior. But then if they become angry, they basically refuse to work and stop producing resources and that sort of thing. So they basically shut down. And at that point, you really have to deal with the situation. Mm-hmm. And one interesting type of desire is the feud, where two clans can start feuding with one another. And there are different types of feuds. So if two clans are in the same field and they both are ambitious, then they can just start fighting, and then they say, hey, all right, you know, kick the other guy out of this field. I want it all to myself because mm-hmm. he's in my way. Or another desire might be, or another feud might be something like, if you have one clan in the settlement that's slothful, and another one that's like, meticulous or something, or, vigorous, then they might have like a philosophical difference and start arguing with one another over that.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these different potential conflicts, and that's something we're looking to flesh out here in the next year or so.
Okay.
It kind of adds a little bit of personality to them, gives you some more strategic decisions that you have to kind of consider. So I didn't want it to be a basic event system where you push a button and it's like, okay, you know, do you want this to happen or that to happen? This is what you get. This is what it costs you. I want it to be a little bit more of, okay, you know, this is an ongoing thing. These are, you know, that's kind of what we call it in code. It's the storylines system. Mm-hmm. So it's not, okay, they got upset. Here's a pop-up, click a button. It's mm-hmm. okay, well, this person comes up, this is what they want. And then it kind of simmers for a little bit, and then it can escalate, or it could kind of, you know, fade away. They could just kind of, you know, just stew silently and keep working, or it could blow up into some big thing. So there's, you know, different directions and go in, and don't want it to be completely predictable. But, you know, if somebody says, you know, this is something I really, really want to do, you're like, all right, well, okay. They're probably going to get angry if I don't give it to them, or do something else to kind of mitigate the situation. So,
okay.
It's almost kind of like resources on the map in a way, where you throw certain things at players and you want them to have different options for dealing with them. But to a certain extent, some of the things are out of the player's control. But ultimately, you want the player to be in the driver's seat for what's going on. You want the player to be able to decide between which resources he or she wants to exploit. You want to mm-hmm. give the player options for how to deal with this this storyline, this desire. You don't want it to just be a basic pop-up or something that just happens and then you deal with it. You need options. You need strategic decisions. So mm-hmm. We're trying to bring that out in the clan system as well as other parts of the game. So it's very much a learning process on the design side. There's not a lot of obvious, all right, well, this is how you do this and boom. Because not a lot of games have done this sort of thing before. You know, we talked about King of Dragon Pass before, briefly, and then Crusader Kings 2, and there's not a lot of other examples beyond that. Mm-hmm. So we're really just having to do a lot of playtesting and see what feels right and what doesn't, and how to make everything fit together.
Definitely a great topic regarding the clan system. As you said, it really sounds like something that's going to not just be a defining feature, but it's going to be one of the things a lot of people are going to talk about at the gates for hopefully years to come at this point.
Yeah, that's the plan anyways.
Mm-hmm. Now, one quick question I want to ask regarding resource that you sort of brought up while talking about the clans and the grading structures. Are all the resources in the game, like in terms of where they're on the map, are they basically placed here from the beginning, or like do they have to be unlocked via research? Sort of like Civilization, where you won't see iron until you research blacksmithing.
Everything is there and available, and there are different states of visibility. So by default, most of the resources on the map are completely invisible. And then over time, you can hear rumors of certain locations, and then you can see the basic type. So is it a herd of animals? Is it a plant? Is it a mineral? Mm-hmm. And then you have to send a surveyor there to actually look at it and figure out what it is.
And then
you can actually use it at that point.
Okay, but it's not like you're not going see a new plant resource unless you research a botanist. It's going to be there. You have to send the guy, and then once you know what it is, you can then decide, okay, do I want to go down the research track to get that specific resource? Do I really need that for my clan or for my settlement?
Yeah, there weren't really barbarian botanists so much, so I didn't want to go too crazy down the research and studying route. You know, I'm calling it the tech tree here in At the Gates, but really it's you're unlocking new professions for the most part. There's some other bonuses, but that's pretty much what the core of the system is. So the surveyor was kind of as far as I really want to go, where it's like, you know, you hear rumors of, hey, there's some animals over there. And you're like, okay, well, we could use animals. We can eat those. Let's send somebody over there to figure out what's going on, if we can actually use it for anything. And being able to see the basic type is enough to kind of get the imagination going and to kind of get you thinking about strategy, at least. So if you discover, or if you hear about a herd of animals of some kind, and then there were nothing else nearby, you might say, oh, okay, well, maybe I should study the ranching profession to see, you know, I could then train a rancher and then grab the animal herd, whatever it is, and then I can potentially turn that into food if I'm running low on food. So there's enough information there to kind of get the wheels or the gears spinning a little bit. Not so much that, okay, well, oh man, here's some, you know, flax or whatever, let me you know, research this or that. But for the most part, you can acquire just about any resource, and that doesn't mean you can actually use it. So you'll need clans and other special professions, like a weaver or a yarn spinner or whatever, to turn the flax into cloth, for example. But even if you don't have that, you build a flax farm, get the flax, you can just sell the flax to caravans that show up, make some money, you know, buy some food with it, buy some iron with it, whatever you need. So it's not you're not completely locked off, but to actually utilize it economically and kind of put it into the resource development chain, you will need to do, you know, again, yes, you know, quote unquote, some research to get to that point, but you're not completely blocked off.
Awesome. Now, I know with At the Gates, we could probably talk for another 3-4 hours. What's amazing is we've only been talking for just under an hour and a half, according to my clock, and it feels like we've only been doing this for 20 minutes. It's amazing how quick time is flying for this cast.
Well, you know, I really do think At the Gates is going to end up being something special. Obviously, I'm ridiculously biased, so take my opinion with a grain of salt. But, you know, if I'm being honest, playing strategy games lately has gotten a lot tougher because, you know, in part because that's the field I work in, but also because I think there's a lot of room for improvement. I think, you know, the Forex genre is pretty much been following the Civ blueprint now for a better part of 20 years, and there's room to kind of to grow far beyond that, and that's kind of what I'm looking for. And you also combine that with things like you know, interface and polish and balance and AI and that sort of thing. And you know, I tend to be a depth over breadth kind of person. I want to pick a few games and really get into them and really enjoy them, invest a lot of time in them and master them. You know, a lot of games just aren't built for that. They just haven't had the time put into them, you know, for financial reasons or otherwise, to get to that state where they can hold up for that amount of time. And, you know, especially on the strategy game side, is tough because I'm like a huge user interface snob, so I try to play some games. I'm just like, oh man, I can't figure out what's going on. What's going on here?
Yeah.
Interface is an unloved art, I fear.
Damn straight. But,
hopefully, At the Gates will turn out a little bit better. But you know, it's one of those things where a lot of times you don't see the problems if you've actually been working on the game or close to it. You just kind of gotta get other people to tell you when things aren't working for you.
Definitely. And I mean, with everything that you keep saying, we could probably turn these into 30, 40 more minute conversations. But I know that you have to go in a few minutes. It's pretty much late on Black Friday, so I'm sure we all have things to go to next. So to wrap things up, I have just generally two quick questions for you. And the first one, just to wrap up, or for now, wrap up our talk on At the Gates. As we said on the cast, you've been working on the game for, I think you said, close to 4 years now?
Well, about three years now. Looking at about four total.
Okay. In terms of like development and early access, do you have an idea of when you're going to put the game out towards like early access or letting more people look at the alpha or beta of it?
Well, we do offer pre-order / early access / whatever through our website, which is atthegatesgame.com. Mm-hmm. So if you actually want to play the game right now, you can go to the website and do that. Although I always give the disclaimer that this is, you know, a game in alpha. It's early, it's rough, it crashes. In a lot of ways, it's not fun. The mid-game falls apart. There's all sorts of things. You know, there's no AI, very little diplomacy, all these sorts of things that make games not fun. But if you're interested in being part of the development process, you know, that's why we have that option available, because, it supports us both financially and also in terms of people lending their time. And that's been really, honestly, incredibly valuable in terms of the development process. Mm-hmm. It's extended the process a little bit, but it's ultimately resulted in a better game. And we couldn't have done it without the people that have helped us along the way. So it is available now. This is probably kind of the state it will be in terms of release or availability until we actually do officially launch the game in about a year or so. Mm-hmm. And, we're not planning on doing Steam Early Access or anything like that. We're kind of keep things under wraps here while it's still under development. And then we're going to launch it as a finished game and for something that people can enjoy. And obviously we did a Kickstarter to help fund the game initially. And then we've had this kind of early access program, available through our website where we kind of ask people to, not share too much about the game externally because it is still rough and still a ways off. And, as an indie, you have to kind of be cognizant of that and not show too much too early because people can, get bored of it and say, well, I heard about this 3 years ago. Whatever. Who cares now? Mm-hmm. When you have a big marketing department, a big marketing budget, you can kind of sustain momentum and that sort of thing. So we're trying to keep things a little bit under wraps and make sure that we can focus on the game and do that part right. But we're doing pretty well on that front and looking forward to finally getting it out there, but not sooner than it's ready.
Cool. All right. So I think with that, my last question for you then, John, is as we all know, we're entering December and Game of the Year award season for the game industry. And chances are I probably won't talk to you again until sometime in 2015. So for right now, do you have any games or picks that you consider, your Game of the Year or the game that you like the most for 2014?
Honestly, I'd probably go with Binding of Isaac Rebirth. So I hadn't played it until Rebirth came out, and then I think I've subsequently bought it on Vita and PS4 and PC. in part because it's like, oh, well, these people want to play. You can can kind of, there's no co-op, unfortunately, which would be a lot of fun, but and pass the controller back and forth. And I originally got out on the Vita because I just love the Vita and I like, being able to throw it on the couch and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But, PS4, big screen, it's very nice. So I've really enjoyed that. It's got some stuff that bugs me a little bit. That's probably another podcast in and of itself. But, it kind of falls into that same vein as a game like Spelunky where you want to explore and you're mastering things and you're getting better. And that's kind of what you take from game to game. You understand what's going on a little bit more. You know what that enemy does. You know what this item does. Mm-hmm. The fact that there are just so many items in that game is just, it kind of blows up my brain in a way, to be honest. I think there's over 500 or something like that. So it's whatever it is, it's definitely beyond the threshold at, past which I will read up on an item, figure out what it is, and then when I get it again 2 days later, I completely forgotten what it was.
Yeah.
But that's part of the fun.
Mm-hmm. I think I read someone that there's going to be an expansion for it. So who knows what else they're going to put into that.
An expansion for Rebirth?
Yeah, I think I heard that. I'm not sure how accurate it is, but someone just like posted like a random thing on my Facebook feed about it.
Wow. Right. Well, I mean, it lends itself well to that. Yep. Yeah. It's, you know, I can definitely respect that. I think, you know, one of these days, maybe I'll tackle a game like that in the genre, but, you know, like we're saying before, you know, it's, I feel pretty good in the strategy game market because, it's like one of those things where, yeah, at the gates, you know, it should be a good game and people are going to buy it and play it and that'll be great and keep doing that. Release a roguelike platformer, you know, 2D action game, whatever. Who knows? You might sell 10 copies. Mm-hmm. So, gotta be careful. So, it's definitely a genre I find myself attracted to. And, you know, Spelunky is probably my favorite game ever. And this is not quite up to that level, but it scratches a similar itch. So, probably my game of the year.
Awesome. And, I mean, again, as you just said, we could spend another podcast or two just talking about Binding of Isaac and roguelike design as it is. All right, and as I've said numerous times on this cast already, we could probably spend the next 3-4 hours talking, and it will only be like 40 minutes for us. But I think with that, we're going to wrap things up. I know, John, you have to get going. And as I said, if I don't talk to you again before the holidays, have a happy holiday, and hopefully we can catch up again in 2015.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Josh, and thanks to everybody for listening, and happy holidays to everybody out there as well. Appreciate you guys spending a little bit of time with me, and Josh as well, and hearing about At the Gates and everything else. So thanks again.
Awesome. So for those of you listening, we're going to wrap up the Perceptive Podcast now. And as always, if you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, we have several options available. For guest posts or for being a guest on the podcast, you can find all that information under Submissions Wanted. And to support our ongoing Patreon campaign, that information is available under our Patreon banner, and both those links are on the front page. By the time you hear this, Cyber Monday should be in full effect. Hopefully you guys won't go completely broke, and have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.